All right. Thank you very much for inviting me to be a part of this interesting workshop. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to be here yesterday, but I'm looking forward to the talks today and tomorrow. Okay, so Juan asked me to try to give, you know, some cosmological thoughts that might be relevant to kilohertz gravitational waves, gravitational wave detection. And so anyway, so I've just tried to cobble together some things that hopefully will be complementary to what other people are talking about. So the first thing I wanted to consider briefly was the question of primordial gravitational waves. Is there anything interesting to say about a kilohertz gravitational wave detector from the standpoint of detecting primordial gravitational waves? So first, if you believe that inflation took place in the early universe, which I increasingly don't believe, but anyway, it's certainly still the conventional belief, then famously inflation would produce by quantum mechanical amplification a spectrum of gravitational waves at very long wavelength. And the traditional story is that the upper limits placed by the CMB at very long wavelengths are so strong that when you extrapolate the spectrum to the shorter wavelengths down to kilohertz, down to kilohertz wavelengths, that the spectrum is just way too weak to detect. And certainly that is, I think, the most plausible scenario, but it's worth considering a way that that could turn out not to be true. You know, so you know, the point is just as you look, you know, as you look back in time toward the Big Bang, you know, stiffer and stiffer energy components take over. So as you look, you know, today we're dominated by dark energy with W equals minus one, but if you look, as you go back toward the Bang, different components that have stiffer equations of state rise faster and eventually come to dominate over one another. So as we look back earlier, matter begins to dominate, and then as we look back even earlier, radiation begins to eventually comes to dominate over that. And the usual assumption is that radiation dominates all the way back to the Big Bang. That's the sort of crucial assumption behind the conclusion that a kilohertz gravitational wave detector can't detect inflationary gravitational waves. You know, but really, we only really have good evidence that radiation dominates back to about the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which was when the temperature was of order an MeV, which is quite low by high energy physics standards, many orders of magnitude below the Planck scale, certainly. So there's a lot of room for, if there is any stiffer component in the universe, there's a lot of room for it to take over at earlier times and be compatible with everything we know observationally. And in particular, one scenario that one can think about to have in mind is that, you know, if at the end of inflation, during inflation, the scalar field is supposed to be slowly rolling, dominated by its potential energy. But if the end of inflation is a transition to where it becomes dominated by its kinetic energy, well, a kinetic energy dominated scalar field has W equals one. So it would be that's a very stiff equation of state. And so over here, you know, it just shows, this figure shows the effect that would have. So here we have, you know, here's the current CMB upper limit on large length scales. And let's suppose the gravitational wave spectrum is just hiding right below the current upper limit. Well, if it's radiation dominated all the way back to inflation, then the expected spectrum at higher frequencies is this one. And as you see, it's orders of magnitude below advanced LIGO, and similarly, orders of magnitude below any corresponding kilohertz gravitational wave detector. But this is roughly the mode that entered the horizon at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So if there was a stiff energy component that took over sometime before Big Bang nucleosynthesis, it has the effect of tilting up the spectrum on shorter wavelengths by an amount that depends on W. So I think here we have, this is W equals 1/3 radiation, 0.4, 0.5, 0.6. The equation of state W, remember, a kinetic energy dominated fluid is W equals 1, which is even considerably steeper than this. And so you see, if you just take the spectrum and then tilt it up a lot due to some stiff component in the early universe, then you can get into the detectable region for by the time you reach kilohertz range. So I personally wouldn't bet on this, but anyway, I just wanted to mention it briefly. So other than this source of primordial gravitation waves, what are the other things to consider? Well, one thing that people consider have thought about is that, you know, after the slow world period of inflation, again assuming that there was inflation in the early universe, what can often happen is that after the field is done slow rolling, it begins to slosh around the bottom of its potential well. And during that period, it can become very, very inhomogeneous due to parametric resonance. This is the so-called phase of preheating after inflation. And that can generate a rather large amount of gravitational waves. And so that's what's calculated in this paper. So here, we don't know the energy scale of inflation. In some sense, the most natural energy scale for inflation, the one that comes if you use the simplest potentials like m squared phi squared or a simple Higgs-like potential, the energy scale of inflation is up at the gut scale, 10 to the 16 GeV, which ends up giving a peak of gravitational waves at about 10 to the 9 hertz. But then as you push the energy scale down, the peak linearly goes down too, so as you, the peak frequency. So if inflation was instead down at 10 to the 9 GeV, then the peak frequency would be at a kilohertz. But you see, even in that lucky situation, the height of the gravitation wave spectrum is 10 to the minus 11. As a fraction of the critical density, it contributes 10 to the minus 11. So that's very low, probably impossible to detect with a kilohertz gravitation wave detector. So I personally think it would be wishful thinking to hope for this source. A more interesting source, in my opinion, is a possible first-order phase transition in the early universe. Famously, people used to hope that there was a first-order phase transition at the electroweak scale when electroweak symmetry was broken in the early universe, and that would give us a peak in the gravitational wave spectrum down in the regime where LISA could detect it. Now we know that the minimal standard model doesn't have a strongly first-order phase transition, so it doesn't produce enough gravitational waves for this to be detectable. So here, the author is imagining some extension of the standard model, some less well-motivated extension of the standard model. So I would personally, given what we know about the structure of the electroweak scale now, namely that there seems to be nothing much going on there besides the standard model Higgs, I would not count on these gravitation waves. But of course, we know as you go to higher energies above the electroweak scale, we know very little. And so here the author was pointing out that if you had a strong first order phase transition at 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 GeV, in other words, as the universe cooled through 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 GeV, that would produce gravitation waves in the LIGO band. And if you go up to 10 to the 9 GeV, that would produce gravitational waves at this kilohertz, in this kilohertz band. And so the first interesting thing to note is that, as shown here, a phase transition at 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 GeV would be in competition, in other words, in the LIGO band, would be in competition with the stochastic background of binary black hole mergers. And so it would be basically, roughly speaking, swamped by those, although maybe it could peak out a little bit, but this is really the most optimistic case here. So
how does GeV convert to Z?
That's a good question. So you know, when you're thinking about these, if you want to know, you know, what primordial moment is associated with a given frequency, the thing you want to think about is if you look at this is some co-moving length scale. For 100 hertz today corresponds to some wavelength. If we follow that co-moving wavelength, back in time, it shrinks, but the Hubble horizon shrinks faster. And at some moment in the early universe, that co-moving scale was equal to the Hubble horizon. That is the characteristic moment at which if there was an event that produced a lot of gravitational waves in the early universe, you would expect to see it today at that frequency. Thank you. So I mean, the first interesting thing to say is that at 10 to the in the LIGO band, you know, it looks unlikely to be able to detect a primordial phase transition, even if one was present. But once you go up to 10 to the, if you moved the spectrum over to 10 to the 9 GeV, so that it was in the kilohertz band, it would essentially lie above this black hole background. And so it becomes considerably more plausible that you could detect it without it being obscured by astrophysical foregrounds, in other words.
There's also a neutron star background.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I'm hoping that at some level that will also be the limiting thing. And I was actually wondering about that. I mean, I don't know whether people have already calculated
an estimation from the current rate, which kind of extends this into up to 400 hertz-ish or a little bit further. And this is higher than the binary black hole background at several hundred hertz.
Oh, really? I would have thought it would go the other way. Okay.
It's at least one plot that I saw.
Hmm.
They're about the same. There are each binary neutron star emits less gravitational waves, but there are way more of them.
Yeah.
And the energy density at about 25 hertz from both of them is, as far as we know, is about the same within a factor of two, with error bars on them of maybe 5 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
But you can probably subtract out the binaries because they're partly resolvable.
Uh-huh. So they're not exactly stochastic.
It's an irremovable background, mm-hmm. but it's our foreground. But it's something that we have to deal with, but not just because they're on top of each other doesn't mean it's an insurmountable problem.
Okay.
But at a higher frequency, like above kilohertz, there is this background from the post-merger emission of neutron stars.
Uh-huh.
It's like 10 to the minus 8 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So it could be larger than this.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if there's any way to remove that.
That one's harder to remove because we don't know the waveforms from post-merge. So until we think that the numericist can give us accurate post-merge waveforms, that one is probably a true stochastic background.
Mm.
And I think it will continue just all the way up to a few kilohertz, right? Because if you look at a gravitational waveform, just one waveform in the frequency domain, the in spiral merger, and then the post merger is just a continuation of this.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is it will go all the way up to a few kilohertz.
Oh, okay. 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 Well, that's very good to know. Yeah. You know. So. So then I wonder if that. So let's just say. So I was going. I was the next. Well, let me do it anyway, just in case, you know. Although I guess it may be that these are undetectable, but I was going to say that, so are there plausible candidates for a phase transition at 10 to the 9 GeV, or is that just wishful thinking? And it's kind of a little somewhere in between. There seem like two best motivated options. One is that in the standard model, it appears that the seesaw mechanism most people imagine that the seesaw mechanism is responsible for the lightness of the three observed light neutrino masses. The heavy masses of the three heavy neutrinos are the only bare masses in the standard model. All the other masses come from the Higgs getting a VeV. It's very natural to imagine that those heavy masses are also coming from another field getting a VeV, not the Higgs, from some earlier phase transition, and in particular, if you look at the particle content in the standard model, there's really one more, without changing the fermions and the charges that we know, there's one more U1 gauge symmetry you can add that's not anomalous, which is baryon minus lepton number. That can be gauged. And then that would have had to have been spontaneously broken sometime before the electroweak phase transition. And indeed, exactly the field that would break baryon minus lepton number would exactly give that new what appears to us at low energies to be an explicit heavy mass term for the right-handed neutrinos. So that looks like a rather well motivated phase transition. The question is at what energy scale is it? And so here, you know, I just have the usual. This is the standard seesaw formula for the light neutrino masses. It's given by the Dirac masses of the right-handed neutrinos divided by their Majorana masses. The Dirac masses are some unknown Yukawa coupling, dimensionless Yukawa y sub d squared times the Higgs-Webb squared, the Higgs-Webb we know, and then divided by the Majorana mass, which is, again, some unknown Yukawa coupling y Majorana times the new field-Webb squared. And so in other words, the new field-Webb is equal to something we know, 10 to the 15 GeV, times this product times this prefactor given by these Yukawa couplings that we don't know. We know, you know, what we know about the rest of the Yukawa couplings in the standard model is that they're all over the map from 1 for the top quark to 10 to the minus 5 for the electron. And so it's certainly would not be impossible. It certainly is perfectly plausible that this prefactor would be such as to bring this, that this, if this prefactor was 10 to the minus 6, then we would have the phase transition right where we want it. But of course, we don't know if it is there or at some higher scale. That's an example of a quite well-motivated phase transition in the early universe, but the hitch is that we don't know exactly where at what energy that phase transition will happen, but it could happen in the kilohertz band. The other option is a somewhat less well-motivated example, but where it really does point to this frequency. So axions are these particles that hypothetical particle beyond the standard model that was introduced to explain the so-called strong CP problem. And then people realized it could also play the role of dark matter. Energy density in axions today as a fraction of the critical density is given in terms of the axion mass by this formula. And so if you wanted this to be the dark matter, that implies a mass for the axion. But then the axion mass is the QCD scale divided by the symmetry breaking scale. So you can then figure out from that what is the corresponding symmetry breaking scale. And it really does turn out to be around 10, you know, 5 times 10 to the 10 GeV, not so far away from the energy that we want. And so, but of course the problem is we don't know that these particles are present. And so anyway, that I'm not sure whether that may all be, this discussion I guess may all be moot if these transitions all are necessarily hidden under the stochastic background from the post-merger waves. Now how high, so these things could in principle be at as high as 10 to the minus 8 of the critical density. How high is that background from the merger waves? Would you estimate?
Certainly of a factor of at least 20 in the merger rate by a neutron star. And that translates directly into the uncertainty into the omega parameter. So really, it could be 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 11, is around that number. But so I...
Uh-huh. Okay.
25.
So good. Yeah. Go ahead.
At 25 hertz, it's 10 to the minus 9 is the number I keep in my head. I mean, yeah, we just continue this plot forward. And that what Alberto is saying is just that big purple band is thick because that's comes in the rate. And if we basically, you can just continue that by I up to another order of magnitude and frequency.
Uh-huh.
So I would say
that seems rather large then.
Yeah, it will be maybe the best fit value will be around 10 to the minus 8.
Uh-huh.
At a kilohertz, And it may, it could be as high as a few times 10 to the minus 8 and as low as 10, maybe 5 times 10 to the minus 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, well, so it sounds like probably a losing battle for the primordial phase transition, but anyway, something to keep in mind.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
You have a very peculiar exponent minus in the energy density from axions, minus 1.18.
Yes.
You know nothing about this? Good.
So this is a numerical fit, the famous numerical fit from Kolb and Turner. You know, you can't exactly analytically calculate the relic abundance. So the basic idea is that the axion was displaced a little bit from its VEV, and then once the universe cooled below once the Hubble constant dropped below its mass, it began oscillating, and its average energy density began to behave like matter. But that's not exactly right. One thing that happens in particular is that its mass turns on at some point. Its mass really isn't a constant. It turns on at the QCD phase transition, and. So when you take that turning on effect and properly this transitioning from sitting still to turning into something that behaves like a matter particle, it's not so easy to analytically calculate something correct, and so they just numerically fit it. Yeah. In other words, if you imagine that it was a strictly massive particle that was just sitting there with a mass for all time. And that at one moment at the moment that the Hubble rate dropped below its mass, it instantaneously transitioned from being stationary to oscillating. You would calculate a minus one here. So this is just. Now the next thing to say is that, so here is a plot from an old paper by Cutler and Holtz from 2009, when people were considering, there had been this proposal about 15 years ago of this gravitation wave detector Big Bang Observer, a follow-on to the LISA mission, which would operate at about 0.1 hertz and to go after the background from inflation, but these guys noticed that it would also detect all of the neutron stars in the universe, and would get luminosity distances and redshifts for them, and so there's maybe a few times 10 to the 5 of those within at frequencies higher than 10 to the minus 1 hertz at any given moment in the observable universe, and so they estimated they're making a plot of the luminosity distance versus redshift from those sources they're placing those all in a luminosity versus redshift plot, and estimating how well you can get how well it constrains the Hubble constant and omega matter today, and also how well it constrains the dark energy, so-called dark energy figure of merit, the area of this ellipse in the plane of the dark energy equation of state today and its rate of change. Crazy well, basically. An interesting question is what relationship the kilohertz detection of these neutron star binaries with kilohertz in the kilohertz band, what relationship it will play, and how well it will do. I don't know whether people, again, this is not the topic I normally work on. I was just cobbling together cosmological thoughts. Have people already calculated this in detail? I understand that. That in the kilohertz case you'll be detecting only the lower frequency, only the lower redshift guys, right? Well enough to, and so so I suppose that means that you'll still get the Hubble constant well, but get much poorer constraints on the on the dark energy equation of state. Is that fair to say? So let's see. So the next thing I wanted to say was that for whatever you do want to do with detecting kilohertz gravitational waves, it'll be important that you want to before they get to the kilohertz band, you want to localize them as well as possible. And in particular, let's say it's a minute from the time they reach 30 hertz to merger. It's more like a day between the time they reach 3 hertz to merger or several days, maybe a week, between when they reach 1 hertz to merger. So you would like to ideally localize them as well as possible during that period between 1 hertz and 30 hertz, the run-up to the merger, to give a heads up to electromagnetic astronomers about where they should be planning to look. The thing about 30 hertz is that 30 hertz is about corresponds to a wavelength of about the radius of the Earth. And so once the frequency gets higher than 30 hertz, the angular localization of that neutron star binary will be achieved by triangulation. You have several different antennas at different points on the Earth, and by looking at the arrival times of the different antennas, you figure out where the source is. But below 30 hertz, that method really doesn't work at all. But there's another method that takes over and in the low frequency regime and does better. So schematically I've represented that here. So in that low frequency regime, there's the wavelength is so long, it's longer than the Earth. And so there's just some gravitational wave signal Hij at the position of the Earth. And then each detector, the alpha detector, measures some linear combination of the components of the matrix Hij. So the alpha detector's signal is the contraction of some antenna, W alpha ij with Hij. With a LIGO type instrument, this antenna is just built from the two arms P and Q of the detector in this way. And I will call it a set of detectors complete if this matrix W alpha ij, let me think of it as a matrix whose first index is alpha and whose second index is ij. So I'll call that network of detectors a complete telescope if that matrix has a left inverse. Because if it has a left inverse, then from my measured signal, signals S alpha, I can apply the left inverse of W to S alpha and recover the full matrix Hij. Okay, and then if I can recover the full matrix Hij, I can determine the direction of the gravitational wave, because it's nothing but the zero eigenvector of Hij. And I can also recover the amplitude of the two polarizations as a function of time by just taking the two polarization tensors perpendicular to Hij and perpendicular to this zero eigenvector, and tracing them together with H. So I can recover everything about the gravitational wave in this case, and it turns out that by this method you can get the angular resolution in the regime where lambda is shorter than the radius of the Earth, then you end up getting an angular resolution like lambda over r times 1 over signal to noise ratio. But in this other regime, you still get, by using this other method, so this does much worse than 1 over signal to noise ratio in the regime where lambda is great, becomes greater than R. But this other effect, if you have a complete telescope in this sense, gets you angular resolution 1 over signal to noise ratio. So this by far is the better, does better. And then you can also, with a complete telescope like this, if you can reconstruct HIJ, you can do, you know, two interesting tests of GR. You can test whether the, here I've been assuming that I've been working in transverse traceless gauge. You can test whether the trace of H really is zero, and you can test whether the, you know, since H has a zero eigenvector, its determinant should be zero. And you can check whether both of those things are true. And so anyway, you can ask, in this regime, where this is the method by which you're localizing gravitational waves, what is the optimal network to localize gravitational waves? And so the first thing is, you know, how many detectors do you need to make a complete telescope? How many detectors do you need to make this matrix W alpha ij have a left inverse? And the answer is, for LIGO, you need at least 5. And then it turns out that the optimal configuration with 5 LIGOs, LIGO-like instruments, is one in which the antenna pattern of the whole network becomes totally isotropic. So it doesn't, so that the signal-to-noise ratio for a given gravitational wave only depends on its amplitude. It doesn't depend on what direction it's coming from or what polarization it is. Okay, it turns out there are these special configurations that can achieve that. And so for LIGO-like instruments, there's a simple way to say what those configurations are. So if AIJ is the antenna pattern for one detector, whose arms are P and Q, and A-twiddle-IJ is the antenna pattern for another detector, with arms P twiddle and Q twiddle, then I'll say that those two detectors are mutually perpendicular, mutually orthogonal, if the contraction of A with A twiddle is zero. And you can show that the 5 LIGO network is in this optimal configuration if and only if every pair of two detectors is orthogonal in that sense. And so here I've just given an example. It turns out that there's a 4-parameter family of those totally isotropic networks. And 3 of those are just the trivial rotations of the whole network around the Earth. But then there's a 1-parameter family of really geometrically distinct networks. And anyway, this is just an example showing, if you look at the green, the 5 green guys here are an example showing that you can make one of these perfect networks where all the detectors actually lie on land. And so again, the point is just that for the early phase, for the day or week before the neutron star merger, to localize it as much as possible, ideally you would have a network optimized to give the best average angular localization, and a 5 detector network all else being equal, a 5 detector network with this orthogonality condition between every pair is what you want for that condition, to optimize that particular thing. Okay, and so then I just wanted to end with a quick word about these ideas applied to space-based detectors. So here's a schematic of the LISA detector. If the LISA detector was just a stationary triangle, LISA detector is a great, incredibly clever instrument and a great gravitational wave detector. And my point is that for low frequencies, it is very suboptimal as a gravitational wave telescope. And so I just wanted to explain what I mean by that and give one possible way to improve that. In other words, it's getting very low angular resolution and very, very low ability to determine the polarization of the gravitational wave given the signal-to-noise ratio with which it's detecting the signal. That's what I mean by suboptimal. So the idea is this, that if LISA if Lisa was just a fixed triangle sitting in space, not rotating or precessing, then it would have, then it would be unable to determine the angular position or polarization state of a gravitational wave it sees. There's a big degeneracy. But, you know, it collects two signals, but it's very degenerate. What two signals? How those two signals map onto the space of possible plane waves? But it manages to break that degeneracy to some extent due to the fact that it orbits around the sun over the period of a year. So it there's a Doppler effect that allows it to localize. The Doppler effect that imposes on the signal that it observes is the dominant way that it localizes signals at frequencies above its sweet spot. And then the fact that the triangle precesses by 2 pi over the course of a year is the dominant thing that lets it determine the angular position of sources that are lower in frequency than its frequency sweet spot. So to some extent, it does manage to break all those degeneracies, but it's just, as I say, it's just very suboptimal. And one way to see part of the issue is supposed to be illustrated here. So for a cosmologist, some of the most interesting LIGO sources are going to be supermassive black hole binaries, because for LISA sources will be supermassive black hole binaries, because LISA will see those out to large cosmological distances. And the problem is that a lot of the most interesting sources merge in much less than a year. So you know, anything above this line merges in a day, anything after entering the LISA band. So LISA sees anything above this line for just a day, and then for 3 days, 10 days, 100 days. And only things below this line last a full year.
What is LISA band? Is it 10 to the minus 4 hertz or something different?
So I use the sort of ELISA band, and so I'm just saying it enters the band once this plot was made. When does the signal-to-noise ratio become more than 1?
Okay.
For the sort of projected ELISA band. So a lot of the most interesting sources actually last for much less than a year. So that means that you don't have time to use this year's worth of Doppler data to the Doppler effect or the precession effect both involve waiting a year to get the full breaking effect. And so, you know, if the angular resolution you expect from a complete telescope that's working optimally is 1 over signal to noise ratio, the one you get for LISA for these supermassive black hole binaries, there's a suppression factor. There's actually at least this suppression factor. For other sources, there's suppression factors for other reasons, but there's at least this suppression factor of 1 year over the time to merger. So you can pay a cost of, you know, of 10 or 100 in angular resolution relative to the optimal angular resolution. So it would be nice to fix that. One thought is, in other words, that we've built the people have invented this beautiful technology, it's a shame that it would be kind of going. It's a shame to let that sensitivity go to waste if one could use it more efficiently. So, you know, one thought is, one point you can make, this is, by the way, this is something that I should mention, have thought about with my former student and now postdoc here, Mohammed Chalabi, this slide, is that, you know, if you had one more satellite, if you have 4 satellites exchanging laser beams, then they form a complete telescope if and only if the 4 satellites don't all lie in a common plane. So that, on the one hand, it sounds like a kind of interesting minimal extension of LISA, but the problem is that it's very hard to find, you know, LISA, one of the beautiful things about it is that you have free-falling orbits that naturally maintain almost an equilateral triangle. And for four satellites in orbit around the sun, you can't do that. You can't find four satellites, four freefall orbits that maintain approximately a regular tetrahedron. So maybe there's something to be done with four satellites, but we haven't figured out yet what the clever thing to do is. You know, a less clever option is just to take three instead of one LISA, to just have three LISAs orbiting. They turn out to form a very nice complete telescope, and so we're still in the middle of calculating for these things. Mohammed is, but. I don't yet have the figures for comparing three LISAs with one LISA, but this is an example if you imagined a hypothetical four satellite tetrahedron sitting just freely floating, which is of course not the realistic case, but the numbers will be almost the same. The LISA numbers are the three LISAs will actually do better than the four satellite case, but. Anyway, this gives you the basic idea that this is for equal mass binaries as a function of the total mass and redshift of the binary, how much the angular area is improved by completing the telescope at different regions in parameter space, and you can improve by more than a factor of 10 to the 4 in a large part of the interesting parameter space. And here's the same plot, but for unequal mass binaries at redshift 1. I don't know whether the possibility of introducing two more LISAs perhaps as an add-on to the original LISA mission somewhere a few years further down the road makes it implausibly expensive once you've learned to make a single copy of three LISAs, that making two more of them would be less than three times the cost of making one of them. But I don't know. Anyway, but that's just a thought. Anyway, those are the thoughts I cobbled together on short notice. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, just wanted to comment on the three LISAs. I mean, there is this, there was this mission concept that I think Searle Finney.
Yes, Big Bang.
The Big Bang
observer. Oh yes. Oh, I should say.
Was indeed three LISA, and then moved also by a couple of decades.
Exactly. I should have mentioned that. In fact, yes. They that's another. In fact, now that you remind me. So first of all, yes. The three LISA concept actually goes back to DeSaigo, I think, was the original ones that proposed that. And I'm blanking on the name of the guy whose idea.
Seiji Kawamura.
Yes, Seiji Kawamura, exactly. And then Big Bang Observer also used that. Used this three LISA idea. And it's just worth mentioning that actually the three LISA idea is good for two reasons. You know, the reason they were using it is because they were working in the 0.1 Hertz regime, where the wavelength of the gravitational wave was short relative to the distance between the LISAs. And so they were using it to get this enhancement. They were in this short wavelength regime, and they were using it to get this enhancement of lambda over the distance between the LISAs in angular resolution. They wanted to be able to localize the gravitational wave sources well enough to get their redshift when they found them. And so what we're pointing out is that it also equally gives a big benefit in the low frequency regime, but for a different reason, because in this low frequency regime, even though you're not doing triangulation, the same three LISAs also complete the telescope in a very nice way, giving an almost isotropic antenna pattern on the sky. So, yeah, mm-hmm. They had these smaller LISAs. Just to be clear, and we're suggesting actually doing honest to God three actual LISAs. But yes, but the idea is the same.
how does localization change if you have two satellites instead of three? I mean, recently with the development of this.
Two Lisas, you mean?
No, I mean, LISA has three satellites, but recently with the development of atomic clocks, people start to think, oh, if we stabilize laser frequency to atomic clock and have two satellites instead of three, how does it influence the localization?
Well, you know, you can't, at low frequency, one LISA has two independent detectors. Again, you need five to be complete. So it's already quite incomplete. So one LISA already is, if it was stationary, it would have massive degeneracies, which is why it would have a multi-parameter degeneracy, which is why when it orbits, it still ends up being quite suboptimal. So if you have just one detector instead of two, then that's even more incomplete. You know, it really means that I'm not sure it does qualitatively worse. I just think it probably does. I'm not sure. It definitely does worse.
But. Yeah, the usual argument of this is that you save one satellite. And I think you need at least still in five detectors in any case, so it's maybe not worth saving money on one satellite.
I mean, with two satellites, at least once you tell me what direction it's coming from, then I can determine the polarization and stuff like that. I mean, there is certainly qualitatively more information in two detectors as opposed to one, but for this purpose, you really need five to do the trick.
One thing people do for space BLVI is to go for slightly eccentric orbits, which would also break some degeneracies in the problem. However, I can imagine the accuracy required to make a detection for such an instrument is much higher. I don't know whether it's feasible, but would it be possible to send one of those spacecrafts on an eccentric orbit that gets slightly closer to the sun, and then you get the Doppler effect, for example, you get a different pattern of velocity. It should help overall.
So you mean you want to send when you say send one of the detectors, you mean one what?
One triangle, I guess. One of the spacecrafts. As long as you know the distance and you have a model for that that's accurate enough, you could use the deviations from a constant velocity around the sun to degenerate some things, or you could also think about things that move out of the plane.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would tend to say that from an experimental standpoint, you know, the key point to say is once you have three, I don't know, are you talking about the three triangle case? In the three triangle case, there's no degeneracy left. It's completely non-degenerate. So the telescope gets everything. So I don't think there is any information left to gain from putting it on a different orbit. It might be that there could be some optimization by putting it on a different orbit, but there's no,
yeah.
I don't think there's any.
That it would get there quicker.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying by more efficient or okay, thanks.
I mean, yeah. Fundamentally, it's getting the full matrix HIJ in both the long and short wavelength regime. Once you have three triangles, so I'm just trying to. I imagine that there is not any gain then in that case. I think it's different than the case of one LISA. In that sense, I bet there's no gain for making one of them elliptical.
So let's send data.